Welcome to another episode of Meenal's World. This is episode 67, and this week I have something very different for you. A couple of weeks ago, I recorded Meenal's World podcast in front of a live audience at the Byline Festival. And this was very interesting because this is the first time not only just recording it live, but also having three different guests in front of me. Now, the title of this panel was called Lessons Learned from COVID. And I was joined by Dr. Julia Grace Patterson, founder of Every Doctor. I was also joined by Lord Victor Adebowale, the chair of the NHS Confederation, and Lorraine Collins, a psychotherapist and qualified cognitive behavioral therapist. Now, before I go into anything, I just want to thank everybody at the team who worked so hard to create this festival, and especially everybody behind the production, because getting the audios, getting the video clips is such hard work, and I'm so grateful to have such a team who are so willing to put this kind of content out. I have never done this before, but I was so happy to be able to do this because we had a live audience and they joined us right at the end and they gave us their questions as well. So I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did recording it live. And if you do, please share this with your friends and family, leave a review on iTunes and subscribe on any podcast app. So without further ado, here's Meenal's World Live from Byline Festival. I'd like to ask Dr. Julia, first of all, going back to March 2020, what was it like for you as the chair of Every Doctor, trying to help NHS staff, trying to campaign for the protection of doctors? What was the feeling like? Because I remember at that time there was a big disconnect between what doctors were feeling, what doctors were saying, and what the media was portraying as well. So what was it like for you, Julia?
Well, thank you, first of all, for hosting me today. And hi, everybody. It was really terrifying. One of the things that we do is run a Facebook forum for about 25,000 doctors. And we were hearing immediately people's concerns and what was going on in their workplaces. And because it was very apparent that there was a disconnect between what was being shared in the media and what the government was saying and the experiences we were hearing from doctors online, we began creating a sort of dossier of evidence, which we're actually going to be launching in Westminster in about a month's time, of a report of what doctors were going through. But the experiences were really, really terrifying. I mean, clearly medics have an awareness about respiratory viruses and the potential ways that they can spread. And so I think when the virus was initially found, there were worries and concerns from doctors that perhaps the general population wouldn't have picked up on. And they became quickly very concerned about the lack of PPE, the lack of protections. And then as the situation developed, the inequality in access of that PPE. And we were finding that themes were emerging about who was deemed worthy of PPE of different grades, the sizing of PPE, because there was a sort of assumption that everybody had a uniform face shape and size, and that, you know, some people had cultural reasons not to wear certain pieces of PPE, and how workplaces were responding to that. And quite honestly, it was horrifying. It was almost like we were being given this this stark insight into the power structures within the NHS, and how that played out was really horrifying as the virus obviously spread and people became very sick, and unfortunately a lot of our colleagues started to die. It was a terrifying time.
And Lorraine, I know you've done a lot of work in psychotherapy and you've done a lot of counselling as well. We were in a disaster situation 2 years ago, and nobody knew how long that would last for, whether it would be 2 months or 2 years. How do you think things could have changed 2 years ago in terms of having that support structure for NHS staff? Because as Julia rightly mentioned, we saw our colleagues dying right in front of us, and we were treating our colleagues as patients. What kind of structures do you think should have been in place at that time for us?
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I mean, it's really difficult to say now in hindsight, because at the time it was just this uncertainty, living in this state of constant fear, panic and dread that was kind of nameless. I mean, from my personal perspective, I think that there should have been more of an immediate response to just kind of be more hands-on, to provide the things that were needed. I think that those infrastructures should have been in place before the pandemic. We should have been set up. So it's very difficult to talk about because it really saddens me that the impact of that will be something that I'm seeing and will be seeing for years to come. So at the time, yeah, there should have been more things in place, but at the time it was a kind of impossible task. So we were kind of thinking on our feet at the time.
And Lord Victor, as chair of the NHS Confederation, I believe you work with NHS trusts and different organisations to strengthen the relationship between staff, NHS staff and the public, and you work quite extensively to reduce health inequalities as well. I just wanted to touch upon what Dr. Julia had mentioned, how we were seeing deaths at disproportionate levels, especially with ethnic minority groups. And that was one of my fears as well, that we were coming home from work and we were seeing the numbers rise and our staff were just going. And there was statistics showing that Black males were 4.2 times more likely to die from COVID-related deaths. So I believe the pandemic was quite good to bubble up all these inequalities and understandings of racial injustices and systemic injustices. And it really brought it to light. Do you think much is being done now, 2 years on? And what's your role in that? And what are you trying to do to reduce that impact?
Okay, so 175,000 people died as a result of COVID, 22.1 million cases. The first 12 people to die in the NHS were all Black people, by which I don't just mean people that look like me, just, you know, I mean politically the Black people. They tended to be people who worked on the front line, who had to see patients, doctors, nurses. What we found was that it wasn't just where these people were placed, often in the clinical settings where you are dealing with respiratory diseases, that's where you find a lot of the Black doctors, a lot of Black nurses. And, I mean, I've always known this. I mean, I've known this because I've been involved in the NHS. You know, 50% of the nurses in London are Black, right? We've never had a Black chief nurse. The NHS is like a pint of Guinness, frankly, and Black people basically have done the grunt work ever since pretty much the NHS started. And so it's not surprising then that those people were likely to die earlier. And it wasn't just people in the NHS, Black people in the NHS, Black people in poor communities, bus drivers, the story of Belly, who was spat on and coughed on by basically a racist in King's Cross and who died of COVID. That happened. They opened the emergency hospitals and they called them Nightingale Centres. And I rang up and said, "What's wrong with Mary Seacole?" You know, and they wouldn't change the name. So this is what I did. I set up the Independent Race and Health Observatory because I wanted to hold a mirror up to the NHS about what was really going on and the dynamics that were being driven into health and care by the pandemic. So we were seeing something that was happening already. What the pandemic did is it drew a red line around it that really you couldn't avoid it, but it was still being avoided. And to this day, it is a struggle, I have to tell you, because it's part of a much bigger issue around race, racism, class. And on top of that, as Julia has said, there is a hierarchy in the NHS. You know, primary care doesn't get the same attention as acute hospital care. We know that. You know, consultants get more attention and have more than basically, you know, I don't say your bulk standard, you know, A&E doctor. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we're trying to do at the NHS Confederation is represent the whole system, not just that bit of it that people think is the NHS. The NHS, just in case any of you's wondering, is not about nurses bouncing on beds. It's actually about keeping people out of those beds as much as anything else. So I'm trying to keep, it's a battle to keep attention on the inequality and the inequity. and the racism. I mean, I'm not going to mince with it. It is racism. That's what it is. And to try and get attention paid to the things that really matter, as opposed to the kind of the power dynamics that in the NHS. So it's not easy work. But and as you pointed out, the next tsunami, the next pandemic, is not going to be about a virus. It's mental health. It's mental health. We are, you know, we have got a major challenge around mental health, and it's young people. This has really sent shockwaves through society.
This is awesome. Our producers are saying for the podcast, if we get even closer to the front, right on your chin, this is first class. Thank you.
So just talking about mental health and the impact it's had, not just on the general public, I'm sure a lot of us over here today had a lot to deal with in the last 2 years. It's been a very difficult time. But I feel like it's been particularly difficult, especially for not just NHS staff in general, but those from ethnic minority groups, because we're seeing right in front of our own eyes our leaders neglecting our needs and our leaders not putting their efforts into making sure that there is that equality we're looking for and that equity. And Julia, I believe that you've been working very hard to make sure that doctors feel like they have the agency to speak up, and NHS staff in general as well, nurses, anybody who's working for the system. One of my concerns at that time was, as a brown woman, I wasn't just a doctor, but I was pregnant. So I ticked a lot of boxes when it came to minority groups. I spoke up because I was angry, and that was that one emotion that drove me to speak up. How do you think that we can work with our leaders, such as groups like the NHS Confederation and the NHS Trusts, to give doctors that comfort to say, actually, you can come to us if you have a problem, instead of silencing us?
Oh, it's a really big, really big conversation, and it's something that hasn't had enough attention at all. During the pandemic, I think for people who were paying attention, these trends and these themes became apparent very early on. And just to give you some examples about how these power structures were playing out, at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a real shortage of PPE in hospitals and definitely in primary care. Some GPs were sort of sent one box of 50 masks for the whole surgery with maybe 30 or 50 staff, and that was to last them for 2 weeks or so. Or they'd be told, there's no PPE for you at all, contact local hairdressers and schools and see if anyone's got some masks they could give you. So it was really in short supply, and it got locked in a cupboard with a, you know, a lock on the door, this sort of thing. And we were hearing from people who, you know, a consultant in an intensive care unit would get in touch and say, I don't know what the problem is. I can just unlock the door and take out the mask for my junior member of staff. But then we would hear from a porter or a nurse or a junior doctor in A&E who was perhaps working a temp shift and didn't have a good relationship or a sort of a solid working, I don't know, a sort of sense that they would be listened to. And they would be less likely to approach the person with the key to the cupboard, or they would be turned away. And, you know, all of this was coming out. And so we were running MP briefings, illustrating these types of examples, trying to show what was going on. But there was such a lag in any action being taken. I mean, I really don't think it's been addressed properly even now. As an organisation, Every Doctor is currently doing a research project on structural racism in the NHS, trying to assess what is going on and the information that's currently out there. But one of the biggest problems is that it's not even been something that's had very much attention put on it. So we don't actually have an awful lot of data on structural racism within the NHS, because no one has put the funding in to pay attention. And what Victor was saying about it's like a pint of Guinness, it's absolutely true. It's something that has been disregarded, and we've got to change that. And so I suppose, sorry, this is a long-winded, probably unsatisfactory answer. I think we need to actually start accepting and, you know, naming this. This is an issue, a huge issue in the NHS and society generally, and recognising what's going on, and stop... I suppose apologising for the situation. The reason there isn't a black nurse in charge of the NHS is not because black nurses are worse than white nurses. It's because there's racism inherent in this, built into the system. And until we start exploring it and admitting to it, we're not going to be able to do anything to challenge it, I don't think.
I think one of the surprising moments for me was when the Sewell report came out, Tony Sewell, who wrote the report on racism. And it was a very frustrating report for me to read because it almost just denied the existence of systemic racism and injustice. And I feel like when we're talking about racism, it isn't, and especially the word ethnic minority groups, right? I mean, what does that actually mean? We've got different parts of society. And Lorraine, how do you think that we can work towards creating a system where we're not just looking at ethnic minority groups and saying, okay, this is what we need to tackle. Actually, we've got people from Indian heritage, from Pakistani heritage, from African heritage. Do you think work is being done to compartmentalize these different societies? Because, you know, if I had to go into therapy, I'd love to have someone who understands my cultural background rather than just having someone who's got no clue what's going on, because that plays a big role in my own trauma.
Well, I think it starts from the top. It has to start from leadership, and leaders have to model the model, you know. And I see doctors coming into my private practice because they don't want to seek help. They don't want to seek help from the very people who are, in their words, are their persecutors. Why would you go into the arms of your persecutor where you feel unsafe? So I think that there is something of a silver lining, if you can call it that, in that something has been shone, light has been shone on this situation, that in this chaos, that there are some things that we can start to really start talking about in panels like this, in the work that you've done, in the work that Victor's doing, so that we... You know, we start talking about it and naming it, but it needs to start at the top. It needs to start from leadership. And it means that in some cases, people have to step aside. See, people have to step down to allow other people to show up and make the changes that are needed. I think it's going to be a long, slow process, but hopefully we can just keep going.
Well said.
And Julia, you mentioned about research, not enough research being done. And I feel like these reports are just empty gestures to society to show that they care and they're trying to work on something. But Victor, I know that you're working, as I said, quite a lot to reduce health inequalities. And I'm sure you're very aware of the research that's being done or the efforts that are being put in. At what stage do you feel we should all speak up and say, well, we don't want research, we want action? And we've been talking about these disparities for a long time. And I remember when I was giving birth in the same hospital where Nurse Mary Adjipong had died, and just thinking, well, she was at risk because she was five times more likely to die in childbirth than anybody else in this room. And at what point do you think we have to say, as people here today and people in the audience, say, actually, we've had enough of these reports, we want to see action?
Now would be good. You know, now would be good. A couple of things. One, it would be really good if your work that you're doing on structural racism, it would be really good to join forces, and the Independent Race and Health Observatory would be really keen to hear from you. If you talk to Dr. Habib Naqvi, who runs the observatory, be very keen. Because one of the problems is that people, it's a bit disparate. So there has been, I actually edited the British Medical Journal last year, well, might be the year before last now, February, and the whole edition was on racism in the NHS. And there is a lot of evidence, but it's not all collated in one place.
Absolutely.
So I'd be really delighted to see the RHO used as a platform to get your research out there, because I think that would help. And we need to join up. I do think that the point that Lorraine made is a very powerful one. It's a question of leadership accountability. You know, it's very simple, really. Leadership is fundamentally about leading all the people, all the time, everywhere. Not some of the people, some of the time, somewhere. And if you have a system which results in some people being badly treated, professionally and as patients, then that's a leadership accountability problem. It's as simple as that. And if you can't lead all the people all the time everywhere, don't lead. And it is that. It's about stepping aside.
That's the issue, Victor, is that why are we holding our leaders accountable? Why are we sitting here today and everybody sitting in the room taking that action? Why is that not happening in government itself?
Well, that's a much bigger question. But I think in the NHS, just so that we don't... I think I would argue that there is increasing focus on accountability of leadership. I mean, the current chief exec of NHS England, Amanda Pritchard, is being asked much more, and I ask her to be accountable for leading all the people all the time, everywhere. I met with her the other day about the future of the RHO and what she's doing, and black clinicians and white clinicians as well. It's, I mean, because just in case people think that racism in the NHS doesn't affect you if you're white, there's a very simple statistic, or a very simple fact, that institutions where black people are treated badly provide poor services. That's just for everybody. So it's in everybody's interest to get rid of racism in the NHS. So I think it's not happening as fast as I'd like, and I'm a very impatient person, particularly when it comes to this, but it is happening, and it's starting to make people feel uncomfortable, and there is a bit of a pushback, and I have to say, it's leaked into this culture war nonsense. So my sphere of influence is limited, but there are people, I have to say, sadly, in government, who perceive this whole thing as part of a culture war, and I don't want to talk too long, but I mean, the report that Tony Sewell did has been condemned by every academic that was named in it. I mean, literally all of them have withdrawn their name because actually it didn't deny that systemic racism was happening. What it did is it said that it's very, very rare. That's what it did. That's what the report actually says, which is absolute nonsense. We're talking about it because systemic racism is everywhere. that's the problem. So it's slow. There are forces against it, but I am confident that it will change. I am confident about that. And frankly, anybody in this room who's lucky enough to be here is far too lucky to be pessimistic, so we will change it.
And Victor, you'd mentioned earlier that the next pandemic we'll see is one of a mental health crisis.
Yeah.
And Lorraine, what's it been like for you now, 2 years on, when people are sort of processing the damage that's been done and processing what's happened? I mean, as NHS staff, we're obviously still at work. We're still going into the same hospital where we saw all this trauma. And we don't have the time really to go through therapy because we're still doing our job and we're still trying to save the public. But from a public point of view, people are starting to process everything. People are starting to go out a bit more and sort of and externalize what's happened. Do you think the services to provide that therapy is there? Or do you think that the pandemic has acted as a catalyst, as a wake-up call for the NHS to say, okay, we really need to get out and help these people?
Yeah, I think, firstly, we all have to make time to have therapy and to look after our well-being. I mean, it's like our well-being has started from a different position, you know. And what I'm seeing now is there is a shift, there is a change that, thank goodness, there's more accessibility to therapy, there's more routes into therapy, and companies, not just the NHS, but companies now are making that. They're making certain changes. And what I'm seeing in my practice is that people are coming slowly back to therapy. You know, they stopped coming to see me because they were just basically doing the things that they needed to do, which was, you know, eat, sleep, watch the news, which was re-traumatizing them. And then slowly I had to meet them where they were. And now they've been able to kind of dig deep into a resource that they didn't realize that they had. So that was another kind of positive, if you like, that there was something where they felt, okay, I've been able to adapt. I've been able to use my brain in different ways because I've had to. Some of my My patients were seeing me from their car. Some of them were seeing me from their bathrooms because at home, you know, they were, well, we were in lockdown, so we couldn't go out. So I had to meet them where they are. And I saw that as a tremendous kind of example of resilience and how we're able to kind of keep that pilot light going, you know. And sometimes it was just a flicker. And it was my job to kind of keep that alight, that flicker. But it's difficult. It's difficult. But it's reassuring to see that people are invested now and people are grateful for coming out with something. But there's still a lot of trauma to deal with, and that's going to take some time.
Julia, we're 2 years now down into the pandemic. And, I mean, we're seeing that it, government is saying it's over and live with it. And we know that's not the case. Do you think the feeling generally within NHS staff is that there is an effort to change things? Because I believe Victor just said that at a leadership level, people are trying to make change. And I don't deny that. I don't believe that's not true, that I'm sure that's happening. But from my point of view, and I believe from Julia's point of view as well, we actually want to see it happen in front of us. You know, I want to walk into work one day and sit, and people say to me, look, we understand what you went through. These are the changes we're going to make. And what do you think is happening now, Julie, with NHS staff? Because personally, I feel quite fed up that we saw our ministers and our leaders clap for us every Thursday. They were calling us heroes, they were getting us badges. And then just 2 weeks ago, they said, oh, you've got to pay for your parking now at work. And it's like, well, where are the lessons then? You know, what are you actually trying to achieve from that? But what do you think that the general feeling is of NHS staff now?
Well, my background is as a psychiatry doctor, but I'm not working in psychiatry at the moment. But what I do is run communities. And I guess the community I was mentioning before, the community of doctors, was incredibly energized at the beginning of the pandemic. And despite the trauma that that they were collectively living through, there was a huge amount of solidarity in that anger and that willingness to push back and speak up and advocate for themselves and patients. And in a way that that energy, I think, carried people through for a time. We set up a sort of texting service where people could support our community, and people would just send check-in texts to hundreds of doctors just to make sure that people were okay, because some of our doctors were not okay, some of our members. And then what has happened over the last year is that it feels like the community's trauma has caught up with them. And I'm finding that doctors who were very energetic and energized and feeling hopeful about changing things have gone silent. And it's a complicated thing because we operate on social media and the algorithm changes and we're trying to tussle with that all the time. It's very complicated. But that's really sad at the moment. I'm finding, because I spend my day talking to doctors online, that some people are emerging from that now, and I think it will be very interesting to see what happens next. But currently people are still in survival mode, I think, and really just, like you say, it's like there's a pilot light, there's a flicker. Some people are just about holding on to that hope, but it's really hard for them, I think.
There's a collective fatigue, and I really think that you guys were set up as heroes. It was an impossible task. I mean, you were, it was great work, but it was like, you know, we needed you to be okay in order for us to be okay. You had to survive in order for us to be, you know, for us to survive. So there was no space for you to really think about what you needed. And I remember feeling, well, quite frustrated with that. You know, I don't know how it was for you.
I think there was a real mixed reaction to it at the time. I think some people were just glad to feel like they were part of something bigger than themselves and that they could attach their energy and their focus into being part of a community. But then that fell away at some point. And I think people started being able to focus a little bit more on their own needs and struggling with their mental health in lots of different ways. And, you know, what comes next, you know, what we learn from this is going to be really important, because there'll be a time period where there's an opportunity to challenge things, I think, and demand change. And my personal worry is that we won't be able to harness the energy at the moment we need to in order to push for change. And then everyone will move on because everybody's experienced trauma and in some way they'll want to put it behind them. But I think putting it behind us is a dangerous thing to do because something, it might not be a virus, but something will happen next. And we've got an opportunity now to push for some change, I think.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think, if I may, there's a couple of things. One is the moral harm that was done to people on the front line. And moral harm is caused when you entered into the profession to help and to cure and to support, but you weren't allowed to do that. You're watching people die. And I agree with Lorraine. I think casting you as superheroes meant that you were somehow non-human and therefore you could be treated as such. The pandemic isn't over in the NHS. I'm very, very worried about the numbers of people leaving because they're exhausted. I'm told it's about 7% a month. It's just they've had enough. And I worry about... there was already 100,000 shortfall in NHS staff before the pandemic. It's good to know that about 11,000 people have joined because after volunteering, they've actually decided to become trained as nurses or joined. But we've got a long way to go. And one of the things that I'm seeing happen in good leadership, is you have to acknowledge the trauma and you have to listen to the people who are traumatised and you have to give them control, as much control as possible over what happens next. Bad leadership doesn't listen to you, doesn't allow you to learn from that trauma and then doesn't allow you to use that learning to control what happens next, how you do your work, when you do your work, with whom you work, how you organise it. Institutions that have managed moral harm have found themselves in a place where the people at the bottom are leading what happens next, and it's changing how they deliver services, particularly to those people at the sharp end of the inverse care loss. So I am hopeful, but I'm with you. I think it's incredibly frustrating that the pace of change, but I have to hang on to the fact that it will change and there are methodologies that are out there that are driving that change. We must pursue hope, otherwise we will go backwards.
Just before I open the floor to questions, I have one last question for you, Victor, and that's, you know, working with different NHS trusts and organisations to create change, and Julie doing the same, and as Lorraine as well, speaking up for us was quite difficult 2 years ago as doctors, and this is from a personal point of view, and I believe you felt the same as well, Julia, that speaking up to a system that seems so powerful, and we felt like so tiny in that picture. But I do feel that doctors do play a role in democracy, and I do feel that NHS staff have seen the full spectrum of society, from the richest to the poorest, and we know exactly what everybody's been through in the last couple of years, because we hear these stories firsthand. What do you think can be done to encourage doctors to speak up and feel that responsibility as well? Because it's almost like we've silenced them so much to an extent that speaking up is too scary.
Well, it's interesting, actually. On the one hand, you do say that, I hear what you're saying about doctors speaking up, but the BMA has been very vocal.
But at the same time, we were gagged when we were working in hospitals.
I'm just going to say, as an organisation, the BMA has been very vocal. What has happened in individual hospitals, and it's still happening, and it's really bad. It's not just doctors, nurses, orderlies are being gagged from telling people the truth. But the truth always falls, whether it's like a feather or a cannonball, it always falls, and it will out. One of the jobs of my organisation is to speak truth to power, and we do. And only last week we were telling the government that the pandemic isn't over, that it should be telling people to wear masks, it should be doing a whole load of stuff that it's refused to do. So I would say this as the chair of the NHS Confederation, users, you know, I am not afraid to speak truth to power, and we have done. And we have networks of doctors who are prepared to join us to tell people what it's really like. And only the other week I was telling the government that one of the ways in which the NHS can be changed, saved and changed, is if we are honest with the public about what is truly going on. What worries me at the moment is that we're not being honest with the government about what the NHS can and can't do, what it needs and what it doesn't need. And in the absence of the government doing it, then we will, and we have, and we'll continue to do so.
Julia would like to add something to that?
I think the work you're doing is fantastic, Victor, and I'm sure that there are networks of people speaking up in the spaces that are able to. But I think something that's very difficult at the moment is the unwillingness of the current government and the Conservative MPs to meet with everyday doctors, people meeting, you know, who are working on the front line who have something going on, or a whistleblower, or somebody who's encountered patient safety problems. And what we have found consistently, because we've been running MP briefings for the last 18 months or so about various pertinent topics, is that because the government have such a large majority at the moment, they're not under enough pressure to listen and respond to concerns. And that is causing huge problems. We've been working with lots of different MPs, and I'm not going to say all of the Conservative MPs have, you know, turned a blind eye. They haven't. But it's a huge problem. And a lot of opposition MPs, when they are trying to push a particular issue, will submit questions that aren't answered. You know, there are huge delays. It's been a real problem. And in terms of being gagged as well, I mean, one of the reasons Every Doctor set up in the first place is because there are lots of problems every single winter with patient safety concerns, people being looked after in corridors, dreadful things going on for patients and staff. And we set up an encrypted email service with the support of some investigative journalists who gave us a lot of advice about it. And we were feeding stories to the media, which simply weren't getting out fast enough to create change. And
welcome to my world. This is what we put up with. You've said it. There's an 80-seat majority. One of the ways in which the government avoids dealing with the question is not to ask it, which is why you're not getting meetings with MPs on the front line, because yes, you don't ask the question. I have to tell you that, you know, the mass of clinicians that we represent and health leaders that we represent would agree with every word that you've both said. Our sphere of influence is limited by the fact that we are not the government.
Yes.
And it is exhausting, but we cannot stop. No. That's the point I'm trying to make. It's like, we cannot stop. And yes, what you're describing is exactly what's going on. There is a denial of the truth. There is an attempt to hide the facts under the carpet, but we have to keep pulling the carpet back and telling it how it is.
Well, and I think absolutely, and sorry, I promise this is the last thing I'm going to say. There are long-term issues, which there's going to be long-term work on, things that are as important as structural racism. But one of the things that doctors try to do is shine a light on things which are urgent, because we recognise things in the immediacy that need to be tackled, things like patient safety concerns. I mean, we've taken stories to the media about how, for example, there's no neonatal beds, there's nowhere for, you know, very sick babies to go to in the country, or you know, doctors are being told to discharge patients when they're not safe to be discharged home, that sort of thing. And that's the sort of thing, you can't wait months for a meeting. You need to get the information out there. And many whistleblowers in the NHS have had a terrible experience when they've spoken that truth, you know, if they're not in a safe place to do so. So
Well, I believe by the end of this, Victor and Julia will have a lot to talk about, and lots of collaboration
The point of being a confederation is to protect the few by being part of the many. And so we do tell those stories, and I'm more than happy to continue to do so. It's not easy when you're isolated, which is why you need to be in a movement.
Absolutely.
Sorry to interrupt you guys, but I need to open the floor to questions before we wrap this up. So we've got a few questions. So I'll start off and I'll make my way that way. Shall I pass on? Yeah. Start on, Ollie, do you want to start on this side?
And we'll...
Okay. Okay, fine.
Thank you. Thank you so much for everything. My name is Dr. Maria Norris. I'm especially heartened by the fact that you spoke very directly about inequality and the racism that's inherent in the COVID response. And the reason I say this is because I'm an academic. I research white nationalism and white supremacy in the United Kingdom. And I spend a lot of my time on far-right channels and forums. And it's not fun reading, but it's part of my research. And anyway, what I wanted to say is that those extremists are very much not just aware that COVID has disproportionately impacted people from ethnic minority backgrounds, but they celebrate it and they weaponize it. And that narrative is very much part of is informing a lot of what we're seeing, anti-mask protests and anti-vaccine and anti-lockdown views, etc. But whenever I talk about this on my podcast or on Twitter, I've written about it for the Byline Times, I always get told, and I'm sure you hear this as well, that you shouldn't politicize this. You don't. Why are you playing politics with health? Why are you playing politics with the pandemic? So my question to all of you in the panel is, how do you respond to that when people tell you not to politicize COVID?
Tell them they're wrong. I mean, you know. It's clearly a political issue. You can't, I mean, you know, it behoves us all not to stop telling the truth. It is a political issue, you know. The only defence you have against lies is the truth, and you just have to keep going. I mean, you won't find me or anybody I work with telling you that it's not a political issue. That's, you know, just tell them they're wrong. I mean, it's...
So we have the next question. I believe Ollie will pass on the mic.
Hi, thank you very much. I just wanted to, first of all, say thank you to everyone, because obviously everything that you've all done and that the NHS has done throughout the pandemic has been amazing. I worked in periphery to it, so I know what you guys have been through, and I left my job because it was horrible, so I don't know how you do it. But I guess the main question is, all of this kind of, I don't want to use the word radicalised because it's the wrong one, but it made me realise how glaring the flaws of governance we have are. So I guess, reductive as it is, I have to ask for one point, but what is the one thing that you each wish that they would do better, that they'd not, that they'd have done when all of this started? What do you wish that they'd not done or done to get us out of this situation that we're in now?
I'd like to answer this question first, if that's okay. And I think a lot of you will agree that accountability is the most important thing when it comes to a disaster situation like this. It all starts with accountability. I believe that if a minister makes a decision, if our politicians make a decision that impacts thousands of people and they still deny it, I think that's where things can go wrong, because there's no room to improve. And we're talking about lessons learned from COVID today, and I believe that we have to look at the root issue. And the root issue, in my eyes, is accountability. I don't know if you guys agree as well.
Yeah, I agree, because there's something there about just being transparent. And it kind of links into what you were saying, what I wanted to tell. I wanted to respond by blocking them and just carrying on and just doing what you're doing, you know, because the truth without. But it sends a message then that we're not crazy, you know. It's like, this is what's going on, and we hold our hands up. And so that there is we're starting from a new position of neutrality and a blank canvas. And I think if we're kind of starting on a deck of lies, then it's just going to be flimsy. It's going to collapse. So, yeah.
Julia, would you like to add anything?
I think experts need to be listened to. When we started MP briefings at the beginning of the pandemic, we were doing so because a lot of MPs didn't have access to the expert advice that the government actually were receiving and disregarding. We were trying to spread information. But as a doctor, you know, my background's psychiatry, we had to do an awful lot of work trying to bring the right specialist in, learn from the right people. We were so careful with it, so careful with the information that we were sharing and trying to disseminate. And the government aren't doing that. You know, there's a lot of people who've tried to do lots of positive things and really trying to share the right information, and they're being undermined and disregarded. And that's really dangerous, because the mask thing is all the marches, all the anti-vaxxers. It's become political, and it's actually not become political because of the scientists. It's become political because the politicians have made it political.
The answer to your question is, we should have taken it more seriously sooner. You know, we had actually had about 2 years before that we'd run a big exercise on pandemic preparedness in this country. Not many people know this, but we did. And the outcome of the exercise was, you need more PPE, and you need it in different sizes, and you need to stockpile it. What did we do? We actually cut the department that does the pandemic preparedness, and we didn't buy the PPE, and we just didn't take it seriously. If you look at New Zealand, what we know about leadership in crisis is that you have to act hard, fast. So you have to overreact fast, and then you can start taking the break off. We didn't do that, and then, as many of my colleagues have said, we denied So the second lesson is that you have to learn really quickly. You have to think long and learn short. And we didn't do that. We're in denial. And if you're in denial, you can't learn. So you're bound to make the same mistakes as we did over and over and over again. So, yeah, we needed to have taken it much seriously, much faster. And as a result, hundreds of thousands of people died. And that's what the inquiry will tell us.
Thank you, Victor. We have another question over here.
Thank you. I mean, I commiserate entirely with the evident frustration with the defunding of the health service, austerity and the corruption and fraud by the government and not putting in the correct amount, you know, the proper amount of money that's needed. But my question actually is going to be about social care and the importance of social care in the community as well as in care homes, so that that takes some of the burden away from the NHS.
I'll let Julie answer this question. I know Julie's been working very hard to stop the privatisation of the NHS and to save the values of the NHS in its essence. So, Julia.
It's a really big topic and it's really, really important. And you're absolutely right. There's a system at the moment where the NHS and social care are naturally intertwined, and yet they're seen as two distinct things. And a lot of very unhelpful language is used, for example, bed blockers, to refer to people who are in hospital who need to move into social care and yet aren't, you know, don't have access to it. There's been huge cuts, you know, which is patchy across the country. Some places are disproportionately affected. And my feeling about it actually is there needs to be an honest conversation within the UK by the public about what they want from the future of NHS and social care. And then they need to be involved in the decision making associated with that, because the public are being done to in various ways at the moment. And there's a lot of dishonesty about what's happening in both the NHS and social care. One of the projects we have at the moment is mapping out the outsourcing of services in the NHS, which are being run by private companies or by charities, etc. And the level of awareness in the public is really, really low, because the media don't talk about it, politicians don't talk about it. These places can put the NHS logo on the outside of their buildings, and you know, and there just needs to be a lot more honesty, I think, and people need to be part of that conversation, because social care, like you say, it's also a ticking time bomb. We're an aging population. It's going to get worse. That's all I can say on it, I'm afraid. Like, it's a really sorry state of affairs, I think, at the moment.
Thank you, Julia. Next question.
Hello, my name's Bill Forrester. I've never worked in health, but my father and my sister both had throughout their adult lives. As it happens, just referring back to an earlier point, my wife and I were locked down in New Zealand in 2020, and a proper lockdown, and came back into the British lockdown afterwards, which was quite a strange experience. But my question, I've got two questions actually. One is, does it help to have a black Secretary of State for Health, who I think understands, from what I've seen, some racism better than quite a lot of white people might? And the most senior black nurses, most senior all nurses, do they get coached, mentored, supported to take on the top jobs?
Well, I think it should help. I don't assume that just because a person is black that they understand the dynamics of race. And particularly, that's particularly challenging in a politics of denial. I mean, the last panel talked about the culture wars and all that. So I do think the Secretary of State is treading a very fine line, but he has acknowledged, I mean, I was there, you know, he has acknowledged that racism is an issue. And it's interesting, the successive, usually Tory governments actually, invent words to mean things that we all understand. So now this notion of racial disparity as opposed to racism, or structural racism, has been invented. So there's people looking at that disparity. The RHO is independent and it pushes stuff out that makes people feel uncomfortable. And it will be interesting to see how our relationship with Sajid progresses, because I think he will be under pressure not to do it. To your question about the support for nurses, black nurses, and mentoring. I think this is a real issue in the NHS. So a couple of things have happened. One is that, and it is in good places that are well led, there has been an increase in support for staff in situ. So the introduction of mental health support, not enough psychotherapy in my view, I'll be honest, because it's rare and it's considered expensive, but there's an increasing amount of that. What there isn't, and one of the things I'm working on at the moment, is it is incredibly lonely if you are a black leader in the NHS. It really is, because you are fighting a system which has just presumed that racism was okay for a long time. So you are the person, and I'm sure you've experienced this, often treated like Cassandra. You know, you take him, it's Pandora's box, you're the... And so it's very lonely. So we are, and one of the things the RHO is doing is providing a space for black leaders in the NHS to come together. In fact, in July, we'll be having the first international conference on race, racism, and the NHS, where we'll be support, you know, actually bringing leaders together and actually supporting them. It's only just started.
Victor, I'd just like to add to what Victor said, and I completely agree. We just don't want a token woman of colour, token man of colour in these leadership roles. But also at the same time, if we do put these people in these roles, they have to be people who are not sort of institutionalized in that way of thinking and who are actually there for the people and are not there just to have that job or just to have that salary making their way up to be a prime minister. We need people who really care. And this is why I feel like there's this big disconnect between those working at the top and those working at grassroots. I mean, everything that I've done over the last couple of years with my campaign, I mean, I'd expect NHS leaders to come up to me and say, actually, how can we help you? But actually, they don't want us to exist. They don't want us to be the ones speaking the truth and creating change. And they're actually scared of us. So we need people up there. Yes, we want more people of colour, but not just as a token, for people who truly care about the issues in our society.
I couldn't agree more, to be honest. You know, I think it is very difficult speaking truth to power, but you have to. You can't stop. You just can't stop. It's as simple as that. You don't have any choice.
Well, Victor, I think it's... Obviously, I'm coming out across very passionate about what I've done the last 2 years, but when I was pregnant and I was receiving threatening phone calls from my managers, after being awarded a Lionheart from the England national team and, you know, having leadership national, being recognized nationally, I was still getting threats from my managers. And it just makes you question, what is your job? Is your job there to protect the lies, or is your job there to accept the truth and help us?
I think you've answered your own question.
Sorry, I went on a bit of a rant there. The next question.
Okay. Victor slightly preempted what I was going to ask about, which was Exercise Cygnus, the report in preparedness for a pandemic that was undertaken a few years ago, the results of which were kept secret and only revealed as a result of a freedom of information. My question to you is, to what extent, given these exercises can dispassionately, in non-political ways, practically to show there's a problem, how do we deal with it? How often is just the ability to deal with problems, either on a global scale or smaller scale, purely stopped or interfered with political reasons in ways that ultimately just are detrimental?
I'd like to think that I think it's an increasing trend. I mean, you're all here because you know it's an increasing trend. You know, the creation of new realities. What was it, 1984? The final thing that the government, the most terrible thing the government asked you to do is not to believe the truth of your own eyes and ears. Well, that's where we are, folks. And the denial of that report and the suppression of it is an example of that. You know, if it's inconvenient politically, then it gets suppressed. And Julie's absolutely correct. You know, that's where we are. It's not. You know, it's obvious that's what's going on. They haven't completely, and I do not believe that they have completely succeeded in suppressing the truth. And the success that you both had and you've had and is indicative of that. And conversations like this may seem weak and unhelpful, but I believe that they're very powerful, that these conversations and your podcast and people actually speaking out regardless is incredibly powerful. You know, in complex adaptive systems, small things make a very big difference. And so that's why I say you cannot stop. You can't stop talking about it, because as soon as you do that, then the lie's won.
Would you like to add anything? Yeah.
I think some of it as well is a lot of the blocks that the government seem to be trying to put on people speaking up are that if you try to do it through the usual channels, you get stopped. So like Minal says, often in your workplace, you might struggle to articulate something that's going to get taken seriously and action to be taken. And so what we've been finding is that if you find new ways to speak up, or you sort of take things to the media, or you find a hook, or you spread public awareness in a different way, then you can often get the story out in a way that the government don't expect, and generate energy and speak to people. And, you know, something we've been doing is we took the government to court last summer about PPE procurement, because all kinds of deals were given to friends and associates of the government for PPE, some of which was completely not fit for, you know, not fit for purpose, was wasted, huge amounts of money were wasted. We've been doing that with a Good Law Project. But, you know, from that, that's the platform. We know that the media are interested in the story. So then you create a big public action about it. We were projecting images on big buildings around London about the fact that exercise sickness hadn't been followed, and asking the government what the plan was next, you know. So you can use, you can take one thing and then go somewhere else with it and generate interest, and probably playing the government at their own game, right? With finding catchphrases, create the hashtag, get people talking about one particular thing, and just repeat it and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. And you can lodge an idea into the minds of people, which they won't forget. Right. And that's the way to do it, I think. If we try to do it through the usual channels, it's not working, because they're stopping it from working. They're putting blocks on, you know, all those things.
Thank you, Julia. We've got time for two more questions. So we've got the gentleman.
Thank you so much. First of all, I just want to start by saying thank you for what you've done over the last couple of years. You and other frontline workers, I can't imagine what that would be like, and quite frankly, I don't want to. I want to ask a little bit about the communication at the beginning of the pandemic, when we were told, one of the very first communications was that face masks are not going to help spread, not going to help stop the spread of an airborne virus. Quite clearly a lie, even if it was told as a lie in order to ensure that there wasn't a run on PPE. It sort of set the stage for the way this government was going to communicate to the general population about the virus. How did you respond to that?
Well, I'll let Julie answer this question as well, but I'd just like to add one thing, that one of the things that I realized was that there was a big disparity between, or big difference between, what WHO was saying and what the national guidelines were. And this was one of our issues in our legal case, that why aren't you following the science? And we started to realize our PPE guidelines were changing without rhyme or reason, and they were changing almost on a daily basis. And when we started to look into it, we realized actually it wasn't based on science, it was based on supply. And that was the biggest issue, is that they weren't telling us the truth. They weren't telling us how the virus is spread, just to cover up the fact that they didn't have the right gear. And so this is why the idea of masks wasn't implemented right at a very early stage. Julia, you might want to add to that as well.
Yeah. I mean, everything that you said, basically, there was a lot of fear, wasn't there? And the government misrepresented their behavior in various ways. I mean, there was a Panorama documentary a couple of months into the pandemic about how much PPE they had supplied. And they counted each pair of gloves as two items of PPE, that sort of thing. At the beginning of the pandemic, I'm sure that Minal and I probably had all the same concerns, but we weren't talking to one another because I didn't know about Minal at the time. But we went down outside NHS England with a placard and invited news channels down there saying, we are 1,000 doctors or whatever. We're very, very concerned. We don't have any PPE. What are you going to do to support the workforce? And I had a phone call from somebody very high up within NHS England that afternoon who claimed to me that there were truckloads of PPE driving across the country at the time, and everybody was going to receive their PPE within a couple of days. I think quite honestly, it was an information campaign because they didn't know what to do. And so instead of telling the truth, they decided to lie. And that put a lot of people in danger, because I think had there been an honesty in the way that they conducted themselves as a nation, we probably would have found solutions quicker. In the reality, a lot of money was wasted, a lot of people died, and it's horrifying, really, to think about that.
Yeah, and it would have lowered some anxiety as well, I think. I mean, it was just kind of keeping the anxiety revved up, just being so dishonest about it.
Thank you, Lorraine. Thank you, Julie. We've got another...
I was just going to say, the answer to your question was, I wore a mask. I wore a mask, and I still do on the underground and in crowded places.
Hi, my name's Bex, and I'm a former journalist and a communications professional, and I've just yesterday finished working at a big charity that did stuff during the pandemic. So, and I know stuff about the NHS because this organisation worked with them. So my question was, I was interested in your point about we don't want research, we want action. And I know that measurement of things like racial disparities is something that sometimes the information is not available because it's basically not being measured. So are there things that you know, the panel here, aren't being measured that should be, that would help us to argue for change more effectively, like if that was measured over time?
Yeah, there's loads of them, if I may.
Yeah, Victor, do you mind just bringing your mic closer?
Yeah, there are a few things. So, for instance, up until recently, pulse oximetry, you know those things that you put on your finger that measures oxygen? Well, they don't work for my skin colour, or they give false readings. That was research that was done by the RHO. We've also just, we did a piece of work on health tests for babies. I've forgotten what the name of the test is now, where you look at the colour of their skin to tell whether they're healthy or not. The RHO did a load of work on the causes of infant mortality. One of the issues is that test, because it's a very old test, it's never been reviewed for brown and black babies, basically. So we're not measuring that. During the pandemic, we weren't measuring, we're still not actually, when people died, there wasn't a coding on race or ethnicity or religion. So we had to literally fight the NHS and persuade the NHS to start recording ethnicity. I still think that's weak. We don't record when the cancer weights, when you disaggregate them by race, you find that black people not only have a worse experience, but have worse outcomes pretty much everywhere. We're not really counting that properly. The same goes for mental health. In fact, if you look at all the NHS priorities, you'll find there's a lack of data on race. And then if you look at the workforce, we are just about, there's been a bit of a debate about it, but we're going to do it, looking at things like staff salaries. There are discrepancies depending on what colour you are and people doing the same job being paid differently. There's a whole load of work that still needs to be done on recording of progression, career progression. 44% of our primary care doctors are black, and there's where they work and what they get rewarded for is still... honestly, there's a lot of stuff we don't record. It's bad, and that's why we set up the RHO, because we need the data.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. We're going to have to wrap it up because we've hit the hour clock, but thank you. A big round of applause for our guests today. So we have Dr. Julia Grace, Lorraine Collins, and Lord Victor Adebowale. And a big thank you to everybody who joined us from home as well.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in again this week. And a big, big thank you to the guests who joined me at the festival, and of course, the team at Byline for putting in such hard work to create an amazing 3 days at Notting Hill. If you're new to this podcast, please do leave a review on iTunes. It can really, really help this podcast go a long way. Please do share this with your friends and family, and you can find a library of over 60 episodes on my website. All you have to do is head to mealviz.com and you'll find everything that you need there. You can also follow me on social media at Dr. Meenalviz. And of course, in the show notes, I'll leave all the links that you need to follow all my three incredible panelists. So I'll see you all next week. I hope you enjoyed this live episode. It was something different. But next week, of course, I'll have another guest as usual. I hope you have a lovely week ahead and enjoying the sunshine when you can. And I'll see you all next Friday.